And then, you know, AEI and some other core foundations, American Enterprise Institute, funded the Project for New American Century to kind of galvanize some of this energy in June of 97. So their founding statements, principled statements, kind of reads like a kind of a neocon, you know, world philosophy. We need to increase defense spending. That's kind of core idea number one. To carry out our global responsibilities. We need to strengthen our ties with allies and to challenge regimes hostile to us. We need to promote the cause of political and economic freedom abroad. And we need to accept responsibility for America's unique role in preserving and extending the international order friendly to our security, prosperity, and principles. So this is, you know, protect American corporations anywhere in the world, essentially. And it was kind of this declaration. So when PNAC is founded, there was 25 people who signed that original statement of what they were about. Elliot Abrams, Gary Bauer, Jeb Bush, Cheney, Ilya Cohen, Calizad, Libby, Dan Quayle, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, some of the names we know publicly now. But, you know, there was 25 people. 12 of them went right into positions with Bush the second. And so they were lining up, they were ready, and it took them 3 years to put out the defense strategies, Resource for New Century. That's a document that is often referenced as PNAC's document, the Strategy for a New America Defense. That came out in September of 2000. But they put a number of other policy statements out in that time period and were very active. What's interesting is they're interconnected with, you know, a dozen key policy groups in the country. So this was a new group formed, but it was coming together with energy from a variety of sources. So it wasn't just these 25 guys getting together and say, it's time to do this. So the Defense Policy Guidance document was actually written by Libby and Wolfowitz in 92. It looks very much like what came out of the PNAC in 2000. I mean, some of the language is the same. They use some of the same kinds of adjectives and verbs. And the PNAC one was Steve Carbone was in on that, and a number of others who went on to have high positions in the current administration. So that rebuilding American defenses called for homeland protection. We start to get that use of the word homeland, homeland security, homeland protection. The ability to wage simultaneous wars anywhere in the world, to have a global policing role. In other words, we're going to be the police force for the world. To be able to control space, weapons in space, the weaponization of space, and to be able to make those kinds of, literally, I mean, they would love to be able to, you know, melt Gaddafi as he was giving a speech somewhere with a satellite beam, you know. And they still have these visions of that kind of Star Wars, weapon control, better than anybody else has got. You know, we see the drones and we see that kind of stuff, and that's kind of the beginning. But they have this technology dream. And they also want to control cyberspace. And they just said that right away. I mean, they want to be able to control the information flow in the internet and that around the world. And then they said that the 90s was a decade of neglect, and the U.S. must increase its military power to preserve a Pax Americana. In other words, we're going to impose peace on the world, and we're going to do that militarily. So we've got 700 bases, you know, with forward deployment of troops worldwide. And they identified very specifically Iran, Iraq, North Korea, and particularly China. They spent a good bit of time talking about China, containment of China. China's the major threat, and making sure that we will always have military dominance and being able to control China. So, and they said that, you know, this is going to be a problem because the American people aren't really tuned into, you know, having an empire and global military domination. And we don't even talk about it like that. They didn't want to talk about it like that. But, you know, they said that that's not going to happen. And then, of course, the famous words, unless there's a new Pearl Harbor. So they're laying that right out. And, of course, 9/11 gave us that catastrophe to which they were able to maximize this philosophy and continue military expansion and growth. Who are the beneficiaries from this process? You can identify who the people are advocating for global dominance. You look at who the beneficiaries are, and then you start to put the names of the people that run those boards of directors together in a group and as a list. They all know each other. I mean, they go to different meetings and they talk. I mean, these people, if you're on a board of directors of a major defense contractor, you know all the players. And there's not that many. I mean, our list covers about 240 people. And we show the interlocks between the various groups and who they are. So we looked at the key advocacy groups, PNAC being one, but also the Hoover Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, the National Security Council, Heritage Foundation, the Defense Policy Board, the Committee on the Present Danger, the second one in terms of the one about Iraq, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Manhattan Institute, the Committee on the Liberation of Iraq. That was during Clinton's administration with Bruce Jackson, and they put together this committee advocating the invasion of Iraq back then. The Center for Security Policy, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the National Institute for Public Policy, and the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. So those groups, those 15 groups, are kind of the core philosophical supporters for the PNAC, and money, too, that went in. And you see, and you look at individuals who are giving speeches to these groups, or people coming out of them doing policy position statements and that. And these groups, their core elements are closely interlinked with the top defense contractors in the country. So here's a quote from Condoleezza Rice, and she's speaking at the Hoover Institute in 2000. And actually, she's saying, you know, as the world's leading superpower, the United States has special responsibilities. I like to think about this as a great train that's moving down the track. And the metaphors that get used here are interesting. There's markets and competition for private capital. And Rice is saying, clearly, the United States is kind of in the conductor's seat. And with this position of leadership, we have this responsibility to keep the peace. So, you know, it's kind of quaint, but it's like, okay, we've got to have a military that's going to rule the world. I mean, that's essentially what she's saying. Now, this gets manifested more overtly. We looked at Dick Cheney's speech to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, just in March. On March 7th, he gave a keynote speech to the AIPAC meetings. And this is kind of a telling example of the neoconservative global dominance thought in the current administration. Kind of his, this is his exact words. Israel and the U.S., and all civilized nations will win the war on terror. And to prevail in this fight, we must understand the nature of the enemy. As America experienced on September 11, 2001, the terrorist enemy is brutal and heartless. The enemy wears no uniforms, has no regard for the rules of warfare. Now, this is Cheney. Is unconstrained by any standard of decency or morality. And the terrorists, now this is the part that's incredibly interesting. The terrorists want to end all American and Western influence in the Middle East. Their goal in that region is to seize control of a country so they have a base from which to launch their attacks and wage war against governments that do not meet their demands. Ultimately, to establish a totalitarian empire that runs from southern Spain, across North Africa, through the Middle East, through India and Pakistan, all the way to Indonesia. This is what the terrorists want to do. And you get the ironic, it's a little ironic. And they're trying to build this. So Cheney, you know, he's claiming that there's all these evil terrorists everywhere. They're plotting for the ruin of civilized nations. And that we've got to stop them militarily by controlling all the regions that they're threatening. So this forward deployment, global domination, is clearly written in there. It's designed, you know, we've created this terrorist enemy. And to prevail over totalitarian terrorists, you know, we have to have U.S. domination of the world. Now, when we look back at this, and the early neocons and that, you know, for the last 30 years, there's been really only about 14 foundations that have funded, have been the main funders for these groups, for the Heritage, for the, well, Hoover has been around for a long time, but AEI. In the past 30 years, $177 million has gone to fund the policy directives of the global dominance group, People. 96% of that money came from 10 families controlling 14 foundations. So we're talking about Scafee, we're talking about Bradley, Orlin, and a dozen others, which we list in our paper and that. So it's a narrow group of funders with some big bucks putting in millions of dollars to key groups. And so we see greater evidence of this kind of conversation. Now, we're here in Chicago. As we're speaking, it is 9:10 in the morning in California. The Bohemians are having breakfast. And they're having breakfast out at the Bohemian Grove in Monte Rio on the Russian River in Sonoma County. There's probably about 2,000 to 3,000 of them in there right now. And they will have a speech today at 1 o'clock California time, 3 o'clock our time, which will be some major policy statement speech given by some significant person. And so they're there thinking about these issues. Probably will have something to do with Iran or national security, or right now we're saber-rattling about Iran quite a bit. Well, I attended the Grove in June of 1994, June 4th. So it was this day, that many years ago, 12 years ago, I guess, that I heard this speech. And it was given, and this was a lakeside chat, and I took copious notes. You can't record anything there, but I took copious notes. I was doing my dissertation on them. So I actually got in and got to listen and hear the kinds of conversations that policy elites have. And it was very interesting. But they had a speaker there, and it was representative to me of the neoconservative agenda that was kind of going on and being advocated for at that time that's manifested itself, you know, 10, 12 years later. He was a University of California political science professor. His topic title was Violent Weakness. And he said that there's increasing violence in society that's weakened our social institutions. And just think, there's 2,000 to 3,000 guys sitting in front of this lake. There's no women allowed. And they're 99% white. And they're mostly middle-aged or older. And there's some, one out of three is somebody really important in the country. I mean, they're CEOs of major corporations. And now, I mean, Bush is a member, and, you know, Bush Sr. is a member. They haven't let George in yet, George W., but they will probably. And so, you know, these are some really important people. So the speaker's saying that our social institutions are being weakened, and this is caused by bisexualism, entertainment politics, multiculturalism, Afrocentrism, and a loss of family values and boundaries. And he says, to avert further deterioration, we need to recognize that elites, based on merit and skill, are important to society. And any elite that fails to define itself will fail to survive. We need boundaries and values set very clear. We need American-centered foreign policy. A president who understands foreign policy. It was Clinton bashing. There was a lot of Clinton jokes there then. He went on to conclude that we cannot, and this is a quote, we cannot allow the unqualified masses to carry out policy, and elites must set values that can be translated into standards of authority. So that's that philosophy, and then that gets, you know, portrayed, and it was a standing ovation, and 3,000 guys stood up and were cheering and clapping. And so, you know, this is a stand, right. You know, so, and at the time, I don't think I had appreciated the degree to which this global dominance agenda was kind of emerging within the higher policy circles in the United States. So our next question in terms of the research, okay, so who benefits from this? Who are the people that are benefiting? And how does that manifest in terms of profit margins and that kind of thing? I want to mention one thing. We put together this list of people and we identified all their, I had a couple of students. We worked all last summer, and a lot of this data will be in David Ray Griffin's book that'll come out in September, Post-American Empire, Post-9/11 American Empire, which will be his new book. And we had a variation of this that was published on our website at projectcensor.org. So the data, if you didn't get one of the handout sheets, you can just download it from there. So it puts together things like William Barr. He's on the Carlyle Group board. And, you know, who else he's connected with? He's on the Heritage Foundation. He's in the Hoover Foundation. He was a PNAC person, PNAC. He's on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's an NSA person. And he was a former congressional assistant to Reagan. So you get these people in these high-level positions. It's kind of like a high school yearbook, and they're all in these different groups, you know, and you can go through it, and you can see, well, this person's only in two of them, and this person's in eight of them. But they still all know each other. So, you know, so that's typical. And I don't know how many of you ever heard of William Barr, but, I mean, he's one of the people that are making these policy decisions, and I just picked him for random because he was kind of in the middle group. Some people are in everything, literally. I mean, you look at Cheney and you look at, well, Lynn Cheney, of course, is on the Lockheed Martin Board of Directors, and then she's very active in the AEI, American Enterprise Institute. So who profits from this global dominance policy? So we looked at that question, and we looked at the top defense contractors. I had my political sociology course. Each student took one of the defense contractors and did a full who's on their board and how much was their profit margin. They did these nice charts. It was really fun. And we took some of that data from that, and then we refined it a bit. So Lockheed Martin has probably been one of the big beneficiaries from post-9/11 expansion. Their sales rose by 30% from 2001 to 2004. And their stock value went up 300%. A substantial increase. Northrop Grumman, same thing. Mass big stock increase. DoD contracts in 2001, $3.2 billion. In 2004, $11.1 billion. So quadrupling. Now Halliburton, where Cheney, you know, was former CEO, has seen phenomenal growth. Halliburton had $400 million in government contracts in 2001. 2 years later, they had $4.3 billion. So, and it's cumulative. I mean, you know, they just got the contracts to build more detention centers in the United States. So, Homeland Security and, you know, huge amounts of money. And so their stock, you know, Cheney, he had options on 400,000 shares of Halliburton stock, which at one point was really only worth less than a buck a share. After 9/11, it's now worth about $8 million. So he had this several million dollar increase in value of just the stock he had, and he still gets a couple hundred thousand a year as a retirement benefit from Halliburton. The Carlyle Group, which we know George Sr. was in, a number of others have been consultants and involved with that for a long time worldwide, you know, they have $30 billion in assets. They're a kind of a money management firm, and a very large number of people in the global dominance group are part of them. Carlucci, Bush, Baker, Kennard, Richard Darman. They purchased United Defense in 97, then after 2001, they sold it for a $1 billion profit. So that worked real well for them. So profits for defense contractors are so good that the New York Times in May of 2005 said they got too much money. They're sitting on like $30 billion. What are they going to do with it? You know, they really said this is a problem. Even Boeing at that time had $6.5 billion of cash. So huge amounts of cash have flown into these contractors and top corporations. So we took the top seven defense contractors that had more than a third of their income from defense contracts. So it's a vital piece of their business to be aware of what the policies are in terms of the U.S. We added in Halliburton and Carlyle because of their political connections. So we're not putting, I mean, you take someone like GE, their defense contracts are really only about 5% of their business. I mean, they're just a huge conglomerate, and they own NBC, and I mean, they're huge, but it's not as vital to their business overall, the defense contracts. If you look at Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, their contracts in the government are vital to the success and the continuing success of those corporations, which is the reason why Lockheed Martin gave to two-thirds of the people in Congress. I mean, two-thirds of the people in Congress received donations from Lockheed Martin in the last congressional election in 2004. So they're deeply involved and very interested in the political process. So we list the board of directors of those corporations and the policy council groups and the people that have been advocating for this, and that's kind of how we put that network together. That network also includes direct connections with the corporate media in the U.S. A network analysis of the boards of directors of the top 10 media organizations shows that there's really only 118 people, like darn near fit in this room, that run the corporate media in the U.S., MSNBC, ABC. You know, if you look at their board of directors, we've got 118 individuals. They, in turn, sit on the corporate boards of 288 national and international corporations. So there's this direct interconnect between the media and the big corporations throughout the United States. So they are, when we say media today, it's corporate media. I mean, you literally mean that. They're interconnected with the biggest corporations in the U.S. But they're also, and this is relatively new, very much interconnected with this global dominance group. So William Kennard from the Carlyle Group sits on the New York Times board. He was also former FCC director. Douglas Warner III, who's on Bechtel's board, also sits on GE and NBC's board. John Bryson from Boeing is on Disney's board, ABC. Alwyn Lewis from Halliburton is on ABC's board as well. And Douglas McCorkendale from Lockheed Martin sits on the Gannett board. So you got half of the top 10 with somebody directly from a big defense contractor sitting on the board of director of the big media groups in the country. So this media interlock effectively represents corporate America's interests, and the media has responded to this. So we actually measured the numbers of sites by two of the key global dominance advocacy groups, American Enterprise Institute. The New York Times had 55 quotes in 2000 from AEI, and then after 9/11 in 2005, they had 99 quotes. So that was like an 80% increase. And the Washington Post, same thing. 87 quotes from AEI. In 2005, 157. So it's like every other day, AEI gets in the Washington Post, is quoted on some issue that's going on. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, New York Times, cited them 25 times in 2000, 61 times in 2005. Washington Post, 54 times in 2000, 81 times in 2005. So these global advocacy organizations are getting more sites, more coverage, and they're represented more in the corporate media in terms of their points of view. So that was interesting. I mean, that was certainly something new relative to that. And, you know, when we took a look specifically at Iran and going ahead with a war against Iran, you know, this whole idea that, you know, Iran's going to get the bomb and that there will be this is Bolton's quote. Iran is like 9/11 with a nuclear option. And Rice called Iran the number one terrorist state in the world. This all happened in the same week. Rumsfeld, Bush, all of them, you know, that Iran is so dangerous. And what we found also was that in terms of LexisNexis and newspaper coverage, in 2000, Iran was mentioned 250 times in the major papers in the U.S. This year, it's been 890 times. Negative, I mean, that Iran is a danger. So we've seen a significant increase since 9/11 in terms of coverage of identifying Iran. And the PNAC was saying Iran's the bad guys, you know, 10 years ago. So they're continuing with that agenda. But they have help. And their help is public relation firms. And this is remarkable to us, because I didn't really know this until about a year and a half ago. Public relations industry, since 9/11, has seen phenomenal growth and massive mergers, massive consolidation. So there's three large publicly traded mega corporations now, Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Trust. These firms employ 163,000 people, over 170 countries, and they are a network of... They control a massive amount of wealth. They're interconnected with the most powerful institutions in the United States, corporate and government. And they have direct connections within the global dominance group, the multinational corporations, and the policymaking groups. So, like WPP is a UK-based conglomerate, and they make up Young & Rubicon, Burston Marsellers, Oakley and Mather Worldwide, Helen Knowlton. Remember the incubator babies in the first Gulf War? Well, that was a Helen Knowlton story. And with a number of other PR, advertising, and crisis management firms all over the world. So this control of media, control of the ideas that are being presented, are going through these massive firms. And there's a number of independents, but they're clearly, you know, keenly interlocked. WPP Group, they have four of their members on the Council of Foreign Relations. Omnicom has a position on Time Warner. And Omnicom has somebody, a lifetime member of the PBS board. So they're closely interlocked. And this is management of information and news. And then there's a number of notable, and some like the Lincoln Group, which we've heard about. But you don't hear a lot about the Rendon Group, unless you follow war news. Well, they don't, like, say that they're making the war news, but they do. Rendon Group is the company that has worked since the 80s managing the images of Americans' imperial wars. So they work for Bush. They handled Serbia. They were the first big one was the invasion of Panama. And so they shaped the international support for the first Gulf War. They actually created the Iraqi National Congress and handpicked Ahmad Shalabi to be the head of that. I mean, they got CIA money to do that. So the Rendon Group is, you know, one that manipulates the news. So they're the ones that brought us the pulling down of the statue. I mean, they took the Iraqi National Congress guys, brought them into that square right in front of the Palestine Hotel where the media all was after they'd shot a few of them, and get the tank to pull down the statue, and that becomes a symbolism, and there's people cheering and stuff, which were from the Iraqi Congress that were brought in. It wasn't local people. And that become this image of how the war was going and we were winning and how happy the Iraqi people were that we were there and all of this. And that was the Rendon Group doing that. They also did the Jessica Lynch story. So, you know, Jessica Lynch, the heroic rescue, they've got the camera crews following the special forces into rescue her in the hospital. And that was timed. I mean, that was the day that the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. That's the day we shot the artillery shells in the Palestine Hotel. That's the day we bombed Al Jazeera. And what's on the front page all over the country? Jessica Lynch. That was deliberate. That was the Rendon Group. That was their policies of deception and you know, having stories that lock us out. So the levels of this, the PR firms, the Lincoln Group, now we know, had a $100 million contract. They were paying writers in Iraq to write stories favorable to the military. That came out. They were new. I mean, they were formed less than 3 years ago. And part of their group was this Vincent Beligo, who was a pollster for Reagan and Bush administrations, a PNAC member, Devon Cross, Douglas Dearth, who was a former Joint Military Intelligence Training Center. So these global dominance people are, you know, they'll form a PR company, get a $100 million contract, make money off of this stuff. And they're the ones helping create the lies and the stories that are the propaganda. And then we can get a sense of the money involved here. I mean, the Clinton administration in 2000 spent $38 million on 64 contracts with public relations firms. And you go, oh, wow, that's a lot. You know, I mean, that's creating the news and stuff. Bush, this is from the GOA report, in 30 months from 2003, 4, and half of 2005, spent $1.5 billion on public relations firms and media. So you see the massive increase, and that's part of what's feeding this consolidation of PR firms in the world and creating the news, literally, that we're to cover or not cover.
You're listening to sociology professor and director of Project Censored, Dr. Peter Phillips. Today's show, The Global Dominance Group and 9/11. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So another piece of this, what I think is very important, is, you know, in order to stay in power, they had to win the 2004 election. And it was pretty close. And the polls were, you know, had them neck and neck. And, of course, the media went along. There was no major issues. I mean, Kerry wanted to put more troops in Iraq, and there was a difference in terms of Social Security. This is maybe why 80 million people didn't bother to vote. Maybe Social Security, maybe abortion were issues that bothered people. But for the most part, there weren't key differences. But they were still pretty worried.
Kerry was Plan B.
Clinton was Plan B, too. So, now we all know that Gore won Florida in 2000. I mean, Carter actually came out last fall and admitted that. And they finished that 8-month study in the fall of 2001, where they reviewed 175,000 Florida ballots, not counted in the 2000 election, and analysis by the National Opinion Research Center confirmed Gore had actually won. Well, that news came out after 9/11, about a week later. So, of course, nobody heard it. And so anyway, the 2004 election was just as fraudulent. The official vote count showed that Bush won by 3 million votes. And the exit polls showed Kerry winning by 5 million votes. And most people say, well, exit polls, you know, surveys, how accurate is that? And there's always errors and stuff like that. But in this case, the Edison Media Research and Mitofsky International were the two firms hired to do the polling. It was 13,000 people were polled, which, you know, your normal Gallup poll is about anywhere from 1,200 to 2,000. And that gets you within a 3% plus or minus accuracy rate of the opinions on an issue for the entire population. And unless you ask a question that people don't understand, or, you know, you have a leading question, you want to bring it one way or the other, then the math is right. I mean, you can, but it's pretty difficult to go wrong when somebody's walking out of a poll and saying, who did you vote for president for 5 minutes ago? I mean, most people get that right. And so you got 13,000, so that takes you up to the 99.5% accuracy level in the country if you randomly select people in the polls. So this 8 million vote, the chances of statistically the polls being wrong in the country is about 100,000 to one. That's just the math. But it's interesting because in California and 37 other states, the exit polls match the voter results. They came out the same. The exit polls in California matched what the Secretary of State said the election was. Oh, good. 13 states were major differences, some of which Kerry won, but it would have won by much larger margins. You know, Bush needed that, you know, public mandate for continuing the global dominance agenda, essentially. So these 13 states, I have a list of them here, Colorado, Florida, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nevada, New Mexico, and Ohio. We often just talk about Ohio. That's where the exit polls didn't match the results. And that's where the 8 million votes are concentrated. Now, statistical possibility of that only happening in those states gets you up into the millions to one. Well, 2004 was fraudulent. I mean, there's just no question about it. And Carter and Baker, they had their commission a year ago. They did a report, said, you know, yeah, there were problems. The lines were too long, you know, in some states. And, you know, you had to wait 12 hours if you lived in a black neighborhood in Ohio to get to vote and that kind of thing. And it was raining. And Florida had election, registration problems against it like that. But it was a fair election, and the differences didn't make that much matter. The Democrats don't want to bring this out either. They don't want a populist revolt demanding freedom of information, demanding electoral reform, demanding getting the corporations out of the political process. They don't want that. So they're not going to bring forward information. I mean, why this hasn't come forward as a major story, it beats me. But, I mean, it was one of our top five stories last year. Books have come out about it. Dennis Liu from Cal Poly Pomona wrote a whole chapter in our book about all this is documented. I've got new books coming out of it. Seven Stories Press is bringing a book out on election fraud. It's quite odd. Everybody knows. But it's just not in the front pages of everybody's paper, and it's easy to dismiss as, oh, well, that's just, you know, flaws in the review process or something. Election system software, Diebold and Sequoia, were the three main providers of the voting machine. We all know about Diebold, but there's other companies that provide hardware, you know, the voting machines. And all three have strong ties to the Bush administration, but also their largest investors are Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Electronic Data Systems, and Accenture. Now, Accenture is the new name for Arthur Anderson. And so we've got military contractors that are investors in the hardware of the voting machine process in the country, which is a proprietary-owned machines, at least what's in them, and the software systems, which is the only country in the world that lets that happen. And Diebold had hired SAIC, Scientific Applications International, out of San Diego. Now, SAIC is known kind of as a retirement home for CIA people. It's an international consulting firm. And SAIC on their board of directors is Army General Wayne Downing, former National Security Council, Bobby Ray Inman, former director of the CIA, Admiral William Owens, former vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Robert Gates, another director. They got two CIA directors on their board of directors. So SAIC was the company that did the software security systems in the Diebold machines that we used for our election in 2004. Golly. You know, so, you know, all of this is about looking for suspects. whether it's 9/11 or voter fraud or whatever. You've got people who had means, opportunity, and motive to implement, to promote, and profit from 9/11, voter fraud, from policies of expanded military in the world. And these are the suspects. I mean, if you're going to do an investigation, you make a list of suspects, and then you go find out who had access, who was doing what, where, who could buy thermite quickly and install it. I mean, whatever. You go ask those questions. It's an investigative process. So, you know, David Griffin has published his findings now on the 9/11 Commission report. We've got the Building 7 evidence. So, you know, we're members of the GDG, the Global Dominance Group, involved in 9/11. Well, they certainly advocated for it. And then we certainly know that all the warnings that happened, that they knew in advance that something was pending. So many of them had been warned not to fly, you know, in August of 2001. And I guess Hillary Clinton just admitted to that, too, that they'd been warned not to fly. So they had every opportunity to know in advance. They had abundance of evidence that they had foreknowledge, and we have abundance of evidence that they really wanted something like that to happen. So was there a facilitation? Well, we don't have the individuals without more investigation in terms of who was doing, but we got a little peek when we heard about how Army intelligence specialists working in cooperation with Orion Scientific Systems in 99 and 2000 in a program called Able Danger were monitoring all known al-Qaeda affiliates in the United States and all their communications. They had acquired the equivalent of a quarter of the Library of Congress of data. I mean, a massive amount of data. I mean, they have identified Mohammed Atta and four other of the alleged terrorists at the core of a Brooklyn cell. But it wasn't just that they'd identified them. They'd identified everybody in the U.S. who had talked to them, everybody around the world and their connections, and all of this data was available. They tried three times in 2000 to present that data to the FBI and were turned down each time. They finally did take it to the White House and left a chart. They said, these guys are dangerous. Here's their connections. You ought to do something. The charts disappeared. And then they were ordered, right at the end of 2000, they were ordered to destroy all the data. Major Kleinschmidt, who was the only person in the military side of that that's been able to testify because he's no longer in the military. The Pentagon wouldn't let anybody currently in the military testify. They had hearings in September, and they had hearings in February. And I've read Kleinschmidt now works for Lockheed Martin doing data mining in Iraq. And, you know, part of that revolving door of, you know, military contractors, you know, back and forth. But he testified, you know, he says, we had this data, we had charts, we tried to present it, we were told to destroy it all and to stand down. So he's got that testimony. There's testimony from Orion that. So what the government had at that point, and it had been acquired, half of it from public sources, was pretty solid connections between the key players that had been identified in 9/11 and other people in the country, yet to be identified. So we had, actually, as a high-level military public-private partnership involved a major defense contractor, uncovered U.S. citizens' links to the terrorists, and was officially told to destroy all the evidence. So that's kind of the latest on that Able Danger. We don't know. They go into closed hearings a lot of times, and we don't get to find out all about it, but that's certainly part of it. You know, we now know from Zogby Coal, you know, that half the people in the country don't believe 9/11 was truthful. And actually, half the people in public affairs research in October and a Zogby poll in November were close to half the people in the country demanding impeachment. Now, I wrote a piece that was published a couple months ago in Common Dreams, and was entitled, If There's a National Movement to Impeach the President and the Corporate Media Doesn't Cover It, Is There Really a National Movement to Impeach the President? You know, and that's kind of true. I mean, we used NexusLexis. We looked at letters to the editor in all the major papers in the country. And from October to March, there were 1,000 letters to the editor demanding impeachment of Bush and Cheney in the major newspapers in the country. Now, if you think about, you know, 1 out of 1,000 people might write a letter to the editor. So you start to think about 1,000 letters to the editors in that time period from people all over, just, you know, random people in the country saying that we've got to stop this. It's a major movement. There's major involvement. And We know that city councils, boards of supervisors, the Democratic Central Committees, all over the country are taking this position. It's time to get these guys out. And it's not just about the election. And the Democrats in Congress say, oh, no, we can't have an impeachment. That's not good for the country. Yeah, no, they don't want an impeachment of a president. There's never been one. And it undermines the credibility of the government the way it stands. But, across the country, Sonoma County Democratic Central Committee, the city of Sebastopol 2 weeks ago, townships in Vermont, five townships, New Mexico State Democratic Party, the National Green Party, have all been writing and calling for impeachment just in the last 6 months. And so there's this big call of which most of us don't know about. You know, see little impeachment signs here and there, and are perhaps a little afraid to even think about it, because if it doesn't happen, I mean, if it's not in the corporate media, it's not happening. So unless you're on the internet and you really can do this research and find out the degree to which people agree with us, people in this room, there probably isn't a core ideological or a core political party at this conference. We're spread all over the map, and we know these issues. I grew up in a Republican farm family in the Central Valley of California, and those aren't the Republicans in power today. Those values are not the kinds of things I grew up with. Absolutely. You know? And so that's... So there's lots of good reasons. Not preventing 9/11 is certainly one good reason for impeachment. There's plenty of others. Stealing in the White House, lying to the American public about misleading Congress on Iraq, direct torture of people worldwide, ordering free fire zones in Fallujah and other cities, killing thousands of civilians, usurping the American people's right to know through use of propaganda machines, through PR firms, building imperial presidency by issuing signing statements. They knew well in advance New Orleans was in danger and did absolutely nothing about it. The deaths there, denial of global warming, disregarding peak oil, placing oil industry profits over issues of that concern, violating the Constitution of separation of church and state, failing to prevent 9/11, promoting global dominance of the world by the United States military, and overthrowing the elected president. Another regime change was Aristide in Haiti. So you've got 12 good reasons to impeach the president. You only need one. And along with 9/11, we need to ask these Congress people, hey, it's time to get rid of these guys and to have a popular movement that says no to this kind of abuse and this kind of control.
And that was Professor Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored, speaking on the Global Dominance Group last June in Chicago at 9/11, revealing the truth, reclaiming our future. For more on Project Censored, see projectcensored.org. Last but not least, we'll conclude the program with the remainder of Chapter 4 of John Taylor Gatto's book, The Underground History of American Education, which is not unconnected to the previous material in this show. Gatto began this book by tracing the roots of modern compulsory schooling in America to systems abroad and to prominent American tycoons who were open about its goals of social engineering and service to industry. In this chapter, Gatto has related how he became a teacher in the New York City schools and has described a brutal bureaucracy which seems concerned with anything but the students. Last week, we heard the story of Hector, a brilliant, creative, and insightful teenager in the real world, but considered, in Gatto's words, a dangerous moron, a hopeless case, in the eyes and records of school officials. Gatto quit teaching in 1991 after being named New York State Teacher of the Year. After devoting 30 years to the profession, he has become a prominent advocate of self-directed learning and homeschooling. So we pick up with Chapter 4, titled, I Quit, I Think, from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. I've lived through the great transformation which turned schools from often useful places, if never the essential ones school publicists claimed, into laboratories of state experimentation. When I began teaching in 1961, the social environment of Manhattan schools was a distant cousin of the Western Pennsylvania schools I attended in the 1940s, as Darwin was a distant cousin of Malthus. Discipline was the daily watchword on school corridors. A network of discipline referrals, graded into an elaborate catalog of well-calibrated offenses, was etched into the classroom heart.
At bottom, hard as it is to believe in today's school climate, there was a common dedication to the intellectual part of the enterprise. I remember screaming pompously at an administrator who marked on my plan book that he would like to see evidence that I was teaching the whole child, that I didn't teach children at all. I taught the discipline of the English language. Priggish as that sounds, it reflects an attitude not uncommon among teachers who grew up in the 1940s and before. Even with much slippage in practice, Monongahela and Manhattan had a family relationship, about schooling at least. Then suddenly, in 1965, everything changed. Whatever the event is that I'm actually referring to, and its full dimensions are still only partially clear to me, it was a nationwide phenomenon simultaneously arriving in all big cities coast to coast, penetrating the hinterlands afterwards. Whatever it was, it arrived all at once, the way we see national testing and other remote control school matters like school-to-work legislation appear in every state today at the same time. A plan was being orchestrated, the nature of which is unmasked in the coming chapters. Think of this thing for a moment as a course of discipline dictated by coaches outside the perimeter of the visible school world. It constituted psychological restructuring of the institution's mission, but traveled under the guise of a public emergency which, the public was told, dictated increasing the intellectual content of the business. Except for its nightmare aspect, it could have been a scene from a farce, a swipe directly from Orwell's 1984 and its fictional tele-announcements that the chocolate ration was being raised every time it was being lowered. This reorientation did not arise from any democratic debate, nor from any public clamor for such a peculiar initiative. The public was not consulted or informed. Best of all, those engineering the makeover denied it was happening. I watched fascinated as over a period of 100 days, the entire edifice of public schooling was turned upside down. I know there was no advance warning to low-level administrators like principals either, because I watched my first principal destroy himself trying to stem the tide. A mysterious New Deal was the order of the day. Suddenly, children were to be granted due process before any sanction, however mild, could be invoked. A formal schedule of hearings, referees, advocates, and appeals was set up. What might on paper have seemed only a liberal extension of full humanity to children was actually the starting gun for a time of mayhem. To understand this better, reflect a minute on the full array of ad hoc responses to wildness, cruelty, or incipient chaos teachers usually employ to keep the collective classroom a civil place at all. In a building with 100 teachers, the instituting of an adversarial system of justice meant that within just weeks, the building turned into an insane asylum, bedlam, without a modicum of civility anywhere. This transformation, ironically enough, made administrative duty easier, because where once supervisory intercession had constituted a regular link in the ladder of referral, as it was called, in the new order, administrators were excused from minute-to-minute discipline and were granted power to assume that incidents were a teacher's fault, to be duly entered on the cumulative record file, the pedagogical equivalent of the Chinese dangan. There was a humorous aspect to what transpired over the next few years. I had no particular trouble keeping a lid on things, but for teachers who counted upon support from administrative staff, it was a different story. Now, if they asked for a hand, often they were pressured to resign, or formally charged with bad classroom management, or worst of all, transferred to an even more hideous school in expectation that they would eliminate themselves. Most, under such tension, took the hint and quit. A few had to be pushed. I remember a magnificent math teacher, an older black woman with honors and accomplishments to her name, much beloved and respected by her classes. Singled out for public persecution, probably because she acted as an intractable moral force, a strong model teacher with strong principles. Daily investigative teams from the district office watched her classes, busily took notes in the back of her room, challenged her style of presentation openly while children listened. This went on for 2 weeks. Then the administration began to call her students to the school office to interrogate them, one by one, about the teacher's behavior. They coached some kids to watch her during her classes, coached them to look for any telltale signs she was a racist. Parents were called and offered an option of withdrawing their kids from her classes. Broken by the ordeal, one day she vanished. When my wife was elected to the district school board, one of her first actions was to gain access to the superintendent's private files without his knowledge. Some of those records concern details of official cases of harassment. Dozens of employees had been similarly purged, and dozens more were under investigation in this gulag on West 95th Street. Contacting these people in private, it became clear to me they were far from the worst teachers around. Indeed, some were the best. Their relative prowess had emboldened them to speak out on policy matters and so marked them for elimination. One principal, whose school was the most successful reading environment in the district, received similar treatment, ultimately sentenced to an official Siberia in Harlem, given no duties at all for the 2 years more he lasted before quitting. His crime, allegedly striking a girl, although there were no witness to this but the girl, a student who admitted breaking into the light control panel room in the auditorium where the offense is supposed to have occurred. His real crime was his refusal to abandon phonetic reading methodology and replace it with a politically mandated whole word substitute. I escaped the worst effects of the bloodbath. Mostly I minded my business, trying to ignore the daily carnage. In truth, I had no affection for the old system being savaged, and chaos made it easier for me to try out things that worked. On balance, I probably did my best work during those turbulent years as a result of the curious smokescreen they provided. But accounts are not so simple to balance overall. If I regarded run-of-the-mill school administrators as scared rabbits or system flunkies, the reformers I saw parading through the building corridors looked like stormtroopers and made my skin crawl. On several occasions, energetic efforts were made by these people to recruit my assistance as an active ally. All such appeals I politely refused. True belief they had, but for all of it, they seemed like savages to me, inordinately proud of their power to cause fear, as willing to trample on the decencies as the people they were harassing as indecent. However, it seemed just possible something good might actually emerge from the shake-up underway. About that, I was dead wrong. As the project advanced, schools became noticeably worse. Bad to begin with, now they mutated into something horrible. What shape began to emerge was a fascinating echo of the same bureaucratic cancer which dogged the steps of the French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions. Do-nothing administrators and non-teaching teachers multiplied like locusts. With them came an entirely new class of school teacher, one aggressively ignorant, cynical, and often tied to local political clubs. New categories of job description sprang up like weeds. My own school fell victim to a politically correct black gym teacher imported from New England to be its principal. 2 school-wide riots followed his installation. Mass marches on City Hall transpired, in which local politicians instrumental in the man's selection used school children as unwitting cadres to lobby their favorite schemes in newsworthy children's crusade fashion. A small band of old-fashioned teachers fought rearguard actions against this, But time retired them one by one until, with only an occasional exception, the classrooms of Community School District 3, in one of the most prosperous neighborhoods on earth, became lawless compounds, job projects for the otherwise unemployable. I need to wrap this up so we can get on with things. I have to skip the full story of the Hell's Angel math teacher who parked his Harley Hog outside the door of his classroom, and when the principal objected, told him in front of startled witnesses that if the man didn't shut his mouth, the number-crunching cyclist would come to his home that evening, pour gasoline under his front door, and set his house on fire. I have to skip the hair-raising stories of not one, but three junior high school teachers I knew quite well who married their students. Each, spotting a likely 13-year-old, wooed the respective girl in class and married her a few years later. They took the more honorable course, hardly the outcome of most teacher-student romance, as I was privy to. I have to skip the drug habits of staff in each of the buildings I worked in, and other lurid stuff like that. In the midst of the unending dullness of institutional schooling, human nature cracks through the peeling paint as grass through cement. I have to skip all that. Suffice it to say, my life experience taught me that school isn't a safe place to leave your children. Here's a principle of real education to carry you through the moments of self-doubt. Education is a helix sport, a unique personal project like seatless unicycle riding over trackless wilderness, a sport that avoids rails, rules, and programmed confinement. The familiar versions of this are cross-country skiing, sailing, hang gliding, skateboarding, surfing, solitary mountain climbing, thousand-mile walks, things like that. I think of education as one, too. In a helix sport, the players search for a new relationship with themselves. They endure pain and risk to achieve this goal. Helix sports are free of expert micromanagement. Experts can't help you in that moment of truth when a mistake might leave you dead. Helix sports are a revolt against predestination. Bringing children up properly is a helix sport, forcing you to realize that no boy or girl on earth is just like another. If you do understand this, you also understand that there can exist no reliable map to tell you all you need to do. Process kids like sardines, and don't be surprised when they come out oily and dead. In the words of the Albany Free School, if you aren't making it up as you go along, you aren't doing it right. The managerial and social science people who built forced schooling had no scruples about making your kids fit into their scheme. It's suffocating to the spirit to be treated this way. A young lady from Tucson wrote me, "Now that I'm nearly 25, I can hardly remember why I began to be afraid to go to school." I wrote back that she was afraid because her instincts warned her the school business had no use for the personal growth she sought. All pedagogical theory is based on stages of human development. All stage theories of child rearing talk in averages. The evidence before your own eyes and ears must show you that average men and women don't actually exist. Yet they remain the basis of social theory, even though such artificial constructs are useless to tell you anything valuable about your own implacably non-abstract child. One day, after 30 years of this, I took a deep breath and quit. And that was the conclusion of Chapter 4 of John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. You can download this entire book and find out more about Gatto's work at johntaylorgatto.com. And thanks to 911truth.org, Mushka.com, and Bonnie Faulkner for the recordings used in today's program. You can download this and all previous programs at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
which will come down.